Welcome to the Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I know I always bang on about it, but it's a great bit of kit, well worth getting one. You will absolutely love it. Anyway, on today's podcast, we are going to try and answer the question, what should you eat to achieve maximum health? To answer this question, Tim Spector, author of Spoonfed, why almost everything we've been told about food is wrong. I love talking to Tim, and the regular listeners will know we did a fantastic podcast not so long ago. And I've also been on his, what do you call that thing I went on? A clinical trial, diet trial. I'm not sure what you call it, but I also went on that and thoroughly enjoyed the results and seemed to have reaped the rewards from it as well, going on your Zoe app. But before we get to that, Tim, which I'll talk about, can we talk about your COVID app, which I fill out every single day? How is it looking at the moment? How is your app doing, and how's the virus looking?
The app's doing fine. We're over 4 million downloads, which is fantastic. And I think we have about 1.5 million people regularly doing this every day, which is pretty amazing for something that, you know, came out of nothing and didn't get any support or money from anywhere. A few days ago, the government announced they were finally going to give us some financial support. So the Department of Health are actually given us a grant for a couple of million quid to carry this over the winter, because they clearly feel it's going to be still valuable and we're still going to need it for longer than we initially thought. And it is providing, you know, basic survey data of the whole country that isn't available yet from any official route. So it's doing well. It's interesting because people sort of assume from all the media stuff that there are all these deadly outbreaks everywhere, and you know, it's meltdown in the north of England and other things like this. And what we're showing is much more reassuring, saying that really levels are pretty flat, and that around the country nationally, you know, we don't have to worry too much. It hasn't gone away, but you know, we're back at the low levels we were at the end of June, July, before they started going up again. So I think it's generally reassuring, but I think, you know, it could still get worse as well as get better. So at least we have got a sort of radar device up there. But of course, the more people that use it, the better the detail is on the local areas. And as you've seen, if you've logged in recently, we tell you about around where you live, what's going on, and this is going to be increasingly important for, you know, parents worrying about schools and other things around them locally, because that's what concerns most people, not what's happening, you know, 1,000 miles away.
It does seem a shame that the government can't do a push on it, and also the media get Hancock and people to actually try and go on the TV shows and say download it. I mean, I do it every day. It takes no time at all, and yet gives you valuable information.
Yeah, well, this is what we have been trying to get them to do this. Wales and Scotland NHS did initially endorse it and helped us a bit, but you know, the UK government just say they don't do that sort of thing because it's not, you know, they didn't develop it and they're not in control of it. So you know, at least they're helping a bit now. So we ought to be grateful. And they are doing a few Department of Health ads for those that do watch them. But yeah, clearly, you know, it wouldn't take very much to really ramp up the advertising and put it out there, and then, you know, everyone would be safer for it. I agree.
I think the government need all the information they can get at the moment. My big worry and frustration is I can't see a way out of this at all. Vaccine looks like it's quite a long way away, and it feels like we're going to have to learn how to deal with it, as in deal with the symptoms rather than try and find a vaccine. Is that true, or am I just making that up?
No, I think that's the pragmatic approach, is really to not sit back and say, okay, you know, the vaccine's going to save us or we don't have to do anything. It's how do we adapt our lives to this fact? And we've got to start also thinking about, you know, how we might segregate different groups of risk, because, you know, I, like, you know, 3 or 4 million other people have had COVID And the good news is there's very little evidence that you get it again. So whether you've got antibodies or not, it looks like you're protected to some extent, at least for the moment. And, you know, we need to start integrating this sort of stuff and risk profiles and use all the technology we can to, you know, maximize how we can get the country back and economically better again whilst, you know, allowing our kids to go back to school and things.
What was it like for you? Was it hard work, horrible? Did you get hospitalized? What happened?
No, I mean, I was pretty lucky. I got a mild dose of it, and I got it just as we were into going to lockdown, just as we'd launched the app. So I was sort of high on adrenaline anyway, trying to get the app off the ground. I just felt very tired, and I had a cough that only came on for 2 hours in the evening. And basically that, and I stopped being any interest in food, and it was really just going off my food, being really tired. And out, then it, I got out of breath. And as soon as I did anything, I tried to do one press up and I'd be sort of exhausted. Mm. But luckily I was just sitting at my desk like everyone else. And I could just about function working wise, and it dragged on for about 3 weeks, and I wasn't really better for it until about a month. Mm. But I was, you know, very lucky. I didn't ever had fever, and I never had that typical cough that people describe. But it was a very peculiar type of cough that, you know, again illustrates how weird this virus is and how important it was for us to actually, you know, not just say this is just like a flu, but actually collect all the symptoms. And that's where I think the huge value of this, the app was, is discovering these new symptoms and sort of forcing the government to put it on their list.
Mm. Just finally, hindsight is a wonderful thing. But I think we're going to probably be thankful to Sweden in the long run, because they've given us something else to look at, haven't they? Another option from just locking down countries. What do you make of the Swedish model?
I think it's interesting, and they've basically done it just from the point of view of the hospitals. They've said, you know, the main point of this is to keep the hospitals functioning, not have, you know, bodies in corridors and everything else. And so everyone, healthcare is going to continue to work for everyone. And that's been their main central feature, and everything else is rather secondary. And they have achieved that. And looking at it, their death rates are slightly better than ours, but it is hard to compare because, you know, their population is higher educated than ours. They're not as crowded or squashed together. They, you know, they're generally richer, and they spend much more on their health service than we do. But I think if you remember at the beginning of the outbreak, we were seen as the outsiders in Europe, the only ones who were taking it far too easy. And that bit us, you know, turned around and bit us back. But they carried on. I think their model just shows, in a way, how we're going to have to look at this in the future. You know, I think the interesting cases that we've got at the moment is we're seeing these outbreaks, but we're not seeing an increase in deaths. Mm. And so it's quite likely the virus is changing, and they sort of delayed things by their approach. And it could be that by delaying it, you know, over the summer, they did have less problems. And that's perhaps what we're seeing. But I think it's really interesting now that across Europe, we're seeing these outbreaks, but we're not seeing intensive care units full. We're not seeing increased deaths. We're not seeing it spreading like it did before.
Oh, so, Tim, you sound optimistic. It's amazing. You sound like you're, because I've been suffering quite a lot during this lockdown. I've hated every minute of it, and or the pandemic. You sound like you feel optimistic about where we're going with it.
Well, only because I was very, very pessimistic before. So it's all relative, you know.
Just finally on it then, what do you think about the media's role in it? It's hard, isn't it? Because the media are obviously trying to get clicks. They're trying to get sell advertising and whatever else they're trying to do, trying to get ratings. But the hysterical approach that they take, black and white approach, we're all going to die, or we're all going to do this, or you're going to kill my grandma, or whatever they're saying. It's quite a tough thing for governments and health experts to deal with, isn't it?
I think it is. And I think, you know, when this is over, the media needs to have a look at itself and just say, how did they react to this? And I think they've taken a bit too much of a knee-jerk reaction. And there would have been better if there'd been a sort of rather a closer look at the data the government were giving them, rather than just repeating it and, you know, not commenting on it. I think they should have also looked more at what other countries were doing, which, you know, i.e. making up for what our government wasn't doing. I agree, you know, they, by over-exaggerating some of the risks and the hotspots and things, they sell advertising and things. And it is difficult, and we've got that kind of press that reacts very fast. Very interesting, when I'm talking to American press, they're often given a week to write a story and research it thoroughly and, you know, go into depth and check facts. The journalists today are, you know, literally given an hour to write the story. And I think, you know, I don't blame them. They have a horrendous task to actually, you know, let alone repeat what they've been told to put out, or, you know, to actually start thinking about it and make counter comments is difficult. So I think sometimes the pace of the media has been a problem.
Yeah, is there the new business model? And if we want it for free on the internet, it's got to have advertising on it, and then it's got to be sensational, and we've got to get the clicks. So you get what you deserve in life. That's what I always think. Let's talk about diet then. Tim, I know we've, as I mentioned at the top, we've done a podcast on diet before, and I love talking to you about it. Why are you so interested in diet?
Well, I think everyone is, really. We eat food all the time. We make hundreds of food choices every day. Gives us pleasure, gives us pain. And, you know, now more than ever, we've got more choice in what to eat. And with that increasing choice, I think we've also become more ignorant about it, strangely. So, you know, we've got increasingly lost. And I think the exciting thing for me is that what the new science is delivering on the world of nutrition, which has been a backwater for many years in sort of medicine and science, seen as a newcomer, it wasn't ever given the same prestige. Only really started after the war and was really just focused on vitamins. But now you've got new technologies, with the understanding of how important gut microbes are in altering our health and our food. You've got new ways of measuring food. So you can use chemical analysis now on food. And we now know that, you know, food is not just fat, protein and sugar, but it's actually probably 20 to 50,000 different chemicals that we can now categorize and look at. And I think we've got this new era of personalized nutrition. So suddenly, you know, these one size fits all guidelines, which have been with us since the war, are totally irrelevant. And suddenly all this stuff coming together with artificial intelligence, you know, big data gathering, algorithms, the sort of personalized study that you went into, I think it's just revolutionizing it all. So I think it's a fantastic, exciting time to be interested in the science of food, much so that, you know, more than it would have been 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, I suppose the other thing which has changed dramatically in the last, I don't know how many years, 100 years, 50 years, is that we now have an abundance of food, don't we? Whereas prior to that, I suppose in most countries, including this one, and Jeff, definitely during the war, you were just trying to get calories on board. It doesn't matter what they were because you wanted to survive. Now you've got choice. And with choice comes a lot of food myths and a lot of diets and a lot. We'll talk about a couple of them in a minute, but people now can decide what they're eating. And a lot of people are, would it be right in saying a lot of people are making bad choices?
I think that's right. Or they're being driven to make bad choices. They're being herded down these supermarket aisles towards these special offers and other things towards that. And that's definitely true. So, you know, we now have, you know, more obese people on the overweight people on the planet than people who are starving. So that's an amazing achievement for the human race to have done that. We've switched very quickly from having, you know, all these starving people to all these people with excess in calories. And, you know, they've done a study in the US that they actually produce 3 times more calories per person than they actually ever eat every day.
I suppose, so,
you know, overproduction is absolutely, you know, massive here. And humans just, you know, haven't evolved in that particular scenario, particularly when a lot of this stuff is man-made and sort of engineered to make them eat even more of it, which natural foods rarely are.
I suppose, yeah, I was about to say the evolution is you just try and get as many calories on board for when you can't get calories. So, you know, in the times where you're starving, so you want to get as many on board. We can't switch that. We've not evolved. We can't switch that instinct off, can we? And probably highly calorific foods and sugary foods are things we probably crave.
Yes. No, I mean, that's exactly, you know, because those that didn't wouldn't have been our ancestors. So, and that's similarly why we're taught to, you know, like sweet things and be a bit suspicious of bitter things.
Yes.
Because they often, you know, might have been poisonous plants, all kinds of subtleties here. So I think all these things are important. Mm. Should I do that again? I turn my phone off.
It's fine. You can just turn your phone off though if you want to, if you go there. Yeah. But one of the things that you're keen on, and I like this, is that everybody, and that's I think the reason why I went on your trial, is everybody's body reacts differently to food is the basic principle. So I went on this trial for a few weeks where I listed, you gave me some food to eat and then I listed everything. And then off the back of it, it took a while because...
It's called the PREDICT study.
Yeah, the PREDICT stuff. Yeah, it was a big old trial. And it came back with an app, which I assume we're all going to have in the future, which is great, which can tell me foods that my body likes and food that my body doesn't like as much. And I have to say, Tim, I've pretty much stuck to it. And it's really eased the amount of the way I eat. I seem to be much better at maintaining a body weight than I'm at the moment.
Well, that's great to hear. Because you were one of the first guinea pigs in the study, actually. And so we've so far done about 2,000 people, giving them all exactly the same foods and then logging them with glucose monitors and measuring their fat changes and things like this. And it's, you know, and you were, we collected all kinds of information on you, as you know, and basically everyone was unique. So no two people were the same. And that was even identical twins who were all, you know, majority of the people in the study. You know, that was, to me, amazing. And the fact that when you looked at those graphs the first time, you saw, you know, everyone having those identical muffins and milkshake. And what happened to their bloods afterwards, you know, the inflammation in the blood, the sugars, the fats, you know, no two people had the same pattern. And there were 8-fold differences between individuals. So it's a nonsense to say, you know, on average people, you know, after you've eaten this biscuit, you know, you'll have this or that or whatever. And it's a nonsense to think that, you know, all calories are equal, which means that would be that every single muffin would have exactly the same effect on everybody. And, you know, you're one of the people that's proven that's complete rubbish. And so if you can work out what your unique pattern is, you know, what's the healthiest pattern for you, then you can work it back to the foods and give them scores. And the idea is you're not counting calories, because we think they're pretty irrelevant, really, you know, within the scope of food choices. And allowing people to experiment themselves to see what makes them feel better, which I think is the essence of what we want to try and do, because everyone's, you know, by advertising and habit and culture, forced down certain routes. And also we get into food ruts, don't we? Yeah. The same food after again. So hopefully it's changed your idea a bit about, you know, about what it's like to eat food. And I think these apps will be the future. You know, they will be your friend to guide you into things to eat and perhaps suggest different things you haven't eaten or, you know.
Yeah. Can I just tell everyone, though, that I do have a very varied diet now. I mean, it's not like it restricted my diet at all. I can eat so many things, but it just lists some of the things that I was eating, which were just not beneficial to me. So I've just sort of cut them out, and it's not been hardship at all, really. One of the things I have noticed, though, Tim, and I might be reading into this, so it might be nonsense, but when I look through the foods that I really like, this is fruits and vegetables. Generally, all the fruits and vegetables that my body quite likes that score high for me are British or round here. All the ones which are far flung don't seem to be the ones that my body likes. Is there any, am I reading into that, or is that just, could that be the same for a lot of people?
No one's ever asked me that before. So the honest answer is I haven't got a clue, but whether it's possibly that things that come from, you know, sunnier climes have more sugar in them and are much sweeter than traditional British fruits and vegetables. I don't know. I mean, generally, you know, for most people, an apple is better than a banana, but...
Right, okay. Well, all the fruits and vegetables, my body's likes are things like apples and berries and all that sort of strawberries, blackberries, all those sort of things. So we did
look at genetics, and we saw it had a smaller, much smaller effect than people think. Because as I explained, identical twins, even who have identical genes, had quite different results, and it only explained about 30% of your response to sugar and virtually none to fat. So your British genes, I have to look at that, but I don't think we can put it down to your Anglo-Saxon origins.
Why are there so many old food myths around? Is it just because people like you haven't come along to update them?
I think we like rules. You know, humans like to be told what to do. They like black and white choices, particularly the seems to be the British. You know, we like to know how to queue for a bus. And the more there are these rules, which are seen as sort of facts, it also helps the food industry, because if there are hard and fast rules, they can alter their processed foods to make sure that they get a tick on that one. So if we have a rule that says, you know, you should have something that's low fat, the industry then say, okay, let's arbitrarily just get some level that's low, and then we'll just be 1% below that, and we can put low fat on the cover, and then that accentuates the myth. Similarly with calories, you know, the fact that all calories are equal and that you can count calories, there's, you know, billion-pound industries based on that premise, and again, you know, you can have low calorie labels on foods, and so many people benefit from it. So I think it's this sort of perfect storm of industry lobbying, politicians who like to feel they can do simple things for public health, giving us this sort of simplistic 100-year-old idea of nutrition. That sells products, basically. And
so, what do you think? What do you think about labeling on packaging then? And also, is it helpful at all? And what about label? They're going to start labeling food menus in restaurants, aren't they, soon?
Yeah, this is Boris's big plan to combat obesity. And it's other countries have done it for a while, the US particularly. And basically, most of the trials show it doesn't work. It doesn't work for several reasons. One is that people initially are sort of put off and get shocked by it. But after about 2 weeks, they don't notice it anymore. And the other thing is that it's completely inaccurate. So it can vary by about, you know, up to 40%. And it depends also on the portions you put on your plate. And they're in restaurants, they vary all the time. So and even if you did do it, you know, we know that calorie diets that just involve calorie counting never seem to work anyway for more than a few weeks. Mm. So it's basically a totally negative side for me, because it means that all foods are the same, whether you go to some, you know, homemade artisan vegetarian restaurant with organic foods made in the garden, or you go to a chain of burger restaurants, you know, it's they'll have a calorie count, and that's all that matters. And that is totally the wrong message to give people. And so it doesn't work. But, you know, big industry likes it. And, you know, they presumably, the lobbyists were quite happy to have that passed, because they don't see it as harmful for their products.
Do you find it frustrating, Tim? Do you think we need the media to be a bit more hysterical about this sort of thing, what we're actually eating?
I do. I don't think there's nearly enough discussion on this, and you know, and why, when we had the most successful sugar tax, you know, which went beyond anyone's expectations in terms of its impact, the manufacturers all changed virtually overnight, so they wouldn't be, you know, charged up, and we are eating less sugar, so they've got the method of doing it, and they could have easily expanded that to, you know, 50 other similar foods that we know are bad for us, but they didn't, because of the food lobby, and instead had these rather sticking plaster type approaches which devalue this whole idea. And it would be nice to see more discussion of real food and educating people about food as not just seen as only for foodies or, you know, chefs or people that interest, but it should be basically part of everyone's education, but not just making a brownie, you know, which is the traditional idea of nutrition that takes you a term to make a brownie and then give it to your parents. That was this.
Reading your book is been enlightening, to say the least. I recommend anyone who eats, which is all of us, should have a little read of this, because it does smash a load of myths. One of the ones that I thought was the most interesting for me at the moment is the supplement and vitamin world that seems to be rife at the moment. I don't actually take any, but I don't think anyone I know at the moment is not taking any vitamins. And the big one that everyone's taking because of coronavirus is vitamin D. You know, there's a lot of people saying lacking in vitamin D means if you get coronavirus, you're going to end up hospitalized. Get enough vitamin D. You point out quite rightly in the book, it's not actually a vitamin, it's a hormone, isn't it? And getting too much vitamin D can be bad for you.
Absolutely. So yeah, it would never get a license today if someone had just discovered it, because if you take vitamin C, it's hard to overdose because it doesn't get absorbed into your fat cells, and you just pee it out basically. So you know, that's what it's, you have expensive urine, but that's really what vitamin C is. But vitamin D does accumulate, and whereas most people can't overdose because of the internet, you can now get these tablets which are 20 times as strong as the regular ones, and many people are overdosing on these, and they're having at the same time foods that have many milks and dairy products have extra vitamin D added to them, and we are seeing increasing signs of vitamin D overdose, and then several trials showed that people on the high dose vitamins with osteoporosis were actually falling more and breaking more bones. So to treat these as, you know, harmless, homemade, organic, eco-friendly type medicines is complete nonsense. And I think if we did refer to them as a form of steroid, which the population absolutely fear more than anything, it would be a completely different angle. It's interesting about, as you said, about COVID and vitamin D. I haven't got the results yet, but we asked everyone on the app, as you probably know, what vitamins they were taking. And I think majority of people were taking something. It's quite interesting. And you think, how many billions is that, you know, worth the industry in the hope that they would not get COVID or get it less severely? And, you know, omega-3 was, fish oil is one that's been used massively, and recent huge studies in the US have shown it really doesn't work unless you're in some incredibly starved state. The vitamin C really, it can reduce the length of a cold by about a few hours if you're lucky, if you get it exactly right. And all this hype about vitamin D is all based on some short-term trials of saying, how do you respond to other viruses? And it had, I think if you added them all up, it was about a 15% reduction in getting other viruses, based on numbers of small studies. So, you know, the idea that something like this is going to save you is kind of weird. And I don't know what our results will show. You know, I have an open mind on it. And if it does work, that's great. But it is surprising to see so much support for these things from the government without any real evidence at all. And I find that interesting.
Well, yeah, I went to the doctors a few years ago, and the first thing they did is test me for lack of vitamin D. Seems every single person I know goes to the doctor and says, I'm a bit tired. And rather than them say, well, maybe you shouldn't work 6 days a week, you can get some sleep, they go, here's some vitamin D. And so I ended up taking some vitamin D back then. Do you think the doctors are aware of this supplement world? Because in your book, you say a lot of the supplements and vitamins, they're doing nothing. Do you think the doctors are aware of this?
Not all of them, no. I think they're not always up to date on this stuff. And it's not routinely taught, and many of them are never studied anyway. So it's only the mainstream ones that go through these big trials, and they know that patients like them. So they know that patients like to come away with a prescription of some kind, and they're probably saying, well, it's better than giving them useless antibiotics. Let's give them some vitamins and that, or, you know, because there is a placebo effect of them. And if you do believe in a vitamin enough, it will have some effect. So the key is to, you know, keep that level of, make sure there's absolutely no harm in it. And, you know, plenty of people do swear by vitamins and multivitamins. But the danger, my worry about this is not so much that people pay for their own sort of placebo, which is whereby, you know, you get the benefit just by thinking it works. But that because they're taking these vitamins, they don't worry about the real foods they're eating. And that's part of this vicious circle we're in, where people will just have heat up microwave meals and go weeks without eating a proper cooked food because they say, well, I'm getting all my vitamins I need from a jar.
Yeah, and I'm talking that I always thought the future would be that sort of drink or a tablet where you take all your ingredients, you wouldn't be eating proper food. But it seems to have arrived in a spurious form of powdered protein, which seems to be, if you spend enough time on social media like me, is being pushed to a lot of people as a means to getting fit and healthy, especially for men, to build up bulk and muscle, but also aimed at women as well. That's a real growing trend, isn't it? Powdered protein, whey protein, and things like that. What do we make of that?
Well, the data, I mean, there's very little good data on it, but most of it shows that you don't have to have a lot of protein to build muscle. There's some evidence that if you're in the gym about 4 hours a day, lifting weights, you might need some more. But for most people who have, normal lives, have to work and do things, the idea that you need extra protein to do things, again, is a marketing myth. And there's no real difference also between whey protein coming from dairy or getting your protein from soybeans or peanuts or mushrooms, or the source of the protein isn't important either. So I think there's just, again, it's marketing hype, and it's a danger that people then focus just on that and they have a very non-diverse diet and they're obsessed with the amount of whey protein they can get inside them to bulk up, and that messes up the rest of their nutrition. So yeah, I don't like that trend. And you're seeing these protein bars as well in snacks.
Yeah.
So suddenly that's the new healthy snack food. If you say high in protein, everyone says, "Wow, that's great. No downside there. That's amazing." But if it's high in protein, it's got, what else has it got in it? Not very much. Just means less fat and sugar. But to make it palatable, they're probably going to put all kinds of other chemicals in there.
I suppose what's weird is when you look at a government at the moment, quite rightly obsessing over coronavirus, we're putting so many resources into trying to find a vaccine and good cures and stuff. I mean, we're throwing money at it. And then one of the most important things is what we're sticking in our mouth daily, and we're trying to create good health. You've just quite rightly pointed out earlier that we're becoming overweight, a lot of us, more overweight people in the world than starving people, as you said. It's weird that we're not putting so many resources into people going, okay, everyone's going to be sticking whey protein in the more protein powder. We need to do some studies and science on this, or any of these things that we're sticking inside us. We need to work out what they are. And it seems there's been very few studies and surveys done on what we're actually sticking in our mouths.
Yeah, when you look at the budgets given to study nutrition, things that, as you said, the general public do every day, we just don't fund. We fund masses for rare diseases. We spend, billions on trying to prolong, cancer sufferers' lives by a few weeks. But trivial amounts on actually studying food. And this... it comes home when you start comparing the, I think it's something like, $1 billion to, or over $1 billion to get a single drug on the market. And imagine if that was a new food, how much information you'd have on that. Mm. So we just don't spend anything on food. We see it as not essential, not important. From this older idea that it's all about calories, fats and sugars. And that's absolutely got to change. It is crucial. But nobody's looking at the effects of any new food or new food processing in any great detail on our gut microbes. When we come out with a new artificial sweetener, the only thing they care about is does it give rats cancer? And if it doesn't, go use it in humans. And no one worries that it might affect our metabolism and screw up lots of things about us. So there is a real sort of block in our willingness to spend money examining food. But I'm hopeful that this sort of technical revolution is going to change that. The fact that we can, you can put your food through a Maggi mix and work out what the sort of several thousand chemicals there are in there. And that's going to get cheaper and cheaper. And people will realize that this is a real science, and it's not just making brownies in school. So I think that's, I'm hopeful that it's going to change, but it does need you know, people to come on the bandwagon and start saying how important this is. And, you know, for me, it's all about educating people from an early age how important it is, not coming into it only in middle age.
I think Tim, you better just for anyone who hasn't heard our podcast, our previous podcast, if you could just do a quick summary of what you talk about the gut microbes and how important they've become, and especially you've spent a lot of time studying them, which is kind of a new thing that we're looking at, isn't it, really, in the great scheme of diet?
Yeah, really, it's only been the last 10 years or so that we've really raised the importance of the gut microbes in our health. And these are basically, you know, 100 trillion or so bacteria, archaea, and viruses and parasites that live in this community that really act like a virtual organ in our bodies. So you put them all together, they weigh about the same as our brains. And all of them are chemical factories. The humans only produce about 20 enzymes to break down food, whereas our microbes produce at least 3,000 to 4,000. And so they're perfectly adapted to deal with the food, and that's what we've evolved. We've evolved with them to do that. And they convert the food into other chemicals, and those chemicals act as signals around the body. And those signals do lots of different things. They go to our immune systems and they keep us from getting food allergies. They boost our immunity against infections, including viruses and COVID. But they also send signals to our brain about whether we're full or hungry. They can make the chemicals like serotonin, which can make you happy or sad. And they are also important in how you react to virtually every medicine you take, whether it's as trivial as paracetamol, whether it works for you or not, or whether your life is going to be saved by immune modulating drugs for cancer. And so they're an essential new organ in our body that I think still is not fully recognized and taken seriously by everyone in health and nutrition, because it's been a bit of a niche area. But definitely everyone in the public, everyone interested in food, absolutely needs to know all about gut microbes. And you can now measure them pretty easily. You know, that's the other thing. So there's internet companies, you just get a, you know, like getting a blood test for your stool for cancer, you can send it off, and if the NHS backed it, you know, everyone in the country for less than 10 quid could get their microbes tested.
So the way you always say it is to get healthy microbes is eat a variety of food, eat as many different types of fruit and vegetables, eat fermented food, and that's how you believe to get healthy microbes, gut microbes.
That's right, yeah. So that's the, if you remember one thing about it, it's you need diversity of plants in your diet, and the more diversity, that encourages these different species to live off them. And the more different species there are, more diverse they are, the more different chemicals they'll produce, which makes you tougher and increases your body's defenses.
Okay, so in today's environment with coronavirus around, I imagine having good gut microbes or a healthy environment in your gut is probably a great thing to have, isn't it?
It's looking like that. All the evidence so far from the epidemiology, you know, the people most getting the worst COVID, they tend to be overweight or obese. They've got diabetes. They've got heart disease, metabolic problems. They're living in deprived areas, or they're very elderly. All of those things together, the common denominator is poor gut health and poor immunity. So clearly, this might be the wake up call for many people to start thinking differently about their diets and take it much more seriously. That, because we know that eating junk foods regularly, artificial chemicals, they have the negative effect on your diversity. They will hit your microbes hard. They won't be able to do their normal job. And so, the government giving, you know, all these half price deals on junk food outlets is probably, you know, not in the interest of of the health of those people. Even if it helps the economy a bit, it's going to, you know, cost the NHS more later.
Right. I just want to go through just a couple of things in your book, just to make sure we whet people's appetite. It is great. Let's talk about one which is massive and has been massive in the last few years: the anti-gluten movement. Basically, gluten is bad for you. It's not, is it?
No, gluten's great. Basically, it's, you know, anyone who's had perfect sourdough bread straight from the oven, it's all made with gluten. And it's, you know, gluten just means glue, and it's that sticky, you know, goopy substance that gives it that sponginess and elasticity. And it's been demonized for the last few years as being the arch enemy. And that's just another money-making nonsense into selling gluten-free products, because we think they're less than one in 100 people does actually have a gluten problem, and, you know, have absolutely no problems with them. And some of them get very sick, and it needs to be taken very seriously. But surveys are showing that at least 10 to 20 times as many people who have been misled into thinking they also have a gluten problem, and they don't. And when you do blind testing, you find that the vast majority of those people are not reacting to the gluten. They might be reacting to other things they're eating. They might be eating too many, you know, prepared sandwiches, or they, you know, might be having too much pasta, or other forms of wheat. But all the studies show that those numbers are actually reacting, even what's called gluten sensitivity, are really quite small. I'm not saying they don't exist, but it's been massively hyped. And what's interesting is the whole market for the gluten-free, everything costs about three times as much as the original product. And usually they've got 4 to 10 times as many other added chemicals to try and give it that feel of the natural gluten without it just crumbling in your hands or having a disgusting mouthfeel. So, so take it all with a pinch of salt. If someone's told you you're probably gluten intolerant, by all means, you know, get some tests done. But don't believe the hype. And
it's a minefield out there, Tim, because who do you get to do the test? There's a lot of charlatans out there, aren't there? There's a lot of these cheap tests where they say, I don't know, you're allergic to avocado or something. I mean, there's a lot of these tests out there, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, you're moving to the whole area of food allergies, and yes, that people are making huge amount of money from the current epidemic in food allergy, which is, by the way, it's real. There is an increase in general food allergies, probably because of our junk food diets and our deteriorating gut microbes. But a lot of these tests are pure quackery and have no basis in science. Hair testing, fingernail testing, even some of these home blood tests that they'll tell you which foods you're allergic to, they're generally all nonsense. And you really need to see an allergy specialist, that is the only way to be sure. And I can tell you, speaking to these allergy specialists, you know, 95% of the people they see, they don't have a food allergy. They just have usually an anxious family. And, but it does show that people may just have to change their diets and think more broadly about what they're eating without just blaming one particular ingredient as causing their problems. We tend to oversimplify, and that's a great example of how we always like to blame one thing. Again, it's the simplification. Okay, let's just blame gluten and wheat for all the problems of chronic disease in the West.
And one of the things, Tim, I've noticed on my show, I've got a Sunday brunch. It's a cooking show, and every week we have a list of every celebrity and what they do and don't eat. there's very few who are superhuman like me, who eat everything, dairy, meat, I can eat everything, fish. every single person now has a something. They either don't eat gluten, don't eat dairy, plant-based, pescatarian, vegan. We've got every single, but no one just eats it. It's become a big trend. And I suppose the biggest one is the meat is the enemy now for a lot of people. They've gone vegan or plant-based. And I imagine with the variety, well, you mentioned this in your book, with the variety of vegetables and stuff you can eat on a vegan diet or a plant-based diet, it's good for your gut microbes. Are there any downsides to doing things like vegan diets? And is there anything wrong with eating meat?
Well, there's lots of questions in there.
have you got lots of answers?
I've experimented myself, and I had a period of being vegan and found I didn't feel particularly well on it. And I also missed cheese. So I ended up more or less cutting out meat. I kept the dairy, but I don't, you know, drink milk anymore. So, but I think the main reason to give up meat is to be able to eat more plants. And it just allows your plate to be focused around the plant dish and the tastes of the plant as the central part of it, rather than an accessory to meat. And this is often a problem when people switch from being meat eaters to predominantly plant eaters, is that they're stuck in the old model of meat and two veg, and you just get, you know, mashed potato and beans as your only meal, which is very boring. So it is the first way to get started on a truly diverse plant diet, and the aim is to get 30 different types of plants a week. So yes, giving up meat allows you to do that. Do you have to give it up completely? No, you don't. A lot of the reason people are giving up meat is because for the planet. It used to just be animal welfare. Now the two issues are health and the planet. So the switching from, you know, meat is just not an efficient way. We have to raise so many plants to feed animals to eat meat that it doesn't make economic sense. So I think everyone is eating less meat and going for higher quality meat, being more selective in what they eat, generally I believe is good practice for us trying to keep the planet going, and probably our health as a secondary effect. But high quality meat, is it bad for you? It probably is in very large quantities. The data suggests you might be getting a 10 to 15% increase in heart disease. It's not massive. The main problem with meat for health is on the processed side. The studies are pretty consistent that highly processed, poor quality meat is associated with about a 30, 40% increase in heart disease, a bit less in cancer, and general mortality. But high quality meat every now and again, I think it's probably fine for most people. I would just say, you know, pick your artisan, grass-fed, organic, really tasty one, make a big treat of it. It does give you the vitamin B12 that you need that you can't get from vegan foods. And there are increasing numbers of people with B12 deficiency. So again, everyone is individual. Everyone has got a slightly different need for these four things. I understand why some people won't eat meat at all. But there are some dangers of the vegan diet, particularly in children, that we should be quite concerned about.
What does B12 do?
B12 is essential for many processes in the body. It's particularly useful for the nervous system. And you start to get degeneration of your nerves, and it can affect your brain and cause fatigue and other problems. So it's a general one that causes lots of other minor problems. And it's quite common. And when I started life with a very low B12 level, for example. I got a nasty gut infection when I was 18 and traveling around the Middle East. I never really recovered, and those levels just stayed low, and I just couldn't seem to absorb enough B12. So when I gave up meat, my B12 levels really dropped. So that's why I do try and have an occasional bit of high quality meat to keep me going. And we know that people vary a lot. Some people might naturally have high levels and still be fine as vegans. Others will have problems. So I think being a vegan, that's the one thing you just need to worry about, is to get a proper B12 test every now and again.
But you're okay. I heard that, and I think that's good. But I also heard you say you worry about children being vegan. Why is that?
Again, there's some if children are not exposed to the full range of vitamins, then they can run into problems. And in some countries, it is actually illegal to bring up your children as vegan, particularly before the age of 10, because they are seeing health problems with them and developmental problems. They're not growing properly, etc. So I think as we realize that everybody's in a way unique, some people may be more susceptible to vegan diets than others. Some people will do fine on them. There's a lot we don't understand, because there's many people in Asia brought up without meat from birth, never had any problems, and they might be able to cope on very low levels. So there might also be genetic differences and other things we need to think about. So I don't want to make rules, but I just think everyone who is doing this kind of diet or excluding large things from the diet need to really be good at the research and work out what they need to take. So in a way, B12 might be the one vitamin that I sort of approve of, but everyone needs different amounts, and it's hard to know unless you're tracking it in your blood. Mm.
Tim, thank you so much. We've only just got to the tip of the iceberg of your book. It's such a good read, as always, and thank you for you really have affected my life, because I do have my app now, and to let people know how the app is, it works for me, and I think it's going to be available for a lot more people in the future with blood tests and things, which you can just go to a barcode and put it in, and it tells you how your body should react to that food. And it feels that's the way we're going in the future, doesn't it? So we all know individually, some of us like certain types of food and some of us don't.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting time, this personalized nutrition, and we've now got the tools to do it. At the moment, all people can do is just experiment a bit themselves, which takes, I know it takes a long time to work out yourself what to do, but I think these apps will be the future. And I think we've just launched this product with the company Zoe in the US just last week. And it's probably going to be available in the UK early next year for people to try out. But really, they're trying it out as it's still a giant experiment, because we've done several thousand people. We probably need hundreds of thousands of people until we can actually work out how you'll respond to every food. You know, we can tell generally, but the complexity of food is such that knowing me being able to predict how you're going to respond to, you know, a chicken tikka masala with a, you know, a side order of naan and a pint of lager is going to take a little bit longer, but it's definitely the future. And so if people do want to be the first to test this when it comes out next year, there's a website you guys can go on called joinzoe.com. It's the same company that's behind the app, but there's a wait list there for people. I know there's a lot of interest in the UK to do this, so we're keen to get it here as soon as we can. But I think it's an exciting glimpse of the future, and hopefully it will broaden our choices of food rather than restrict it, which is what most diets do. And I think that's really what I want to, you know, bring back this enthusiasm for trying new foods, and this hopefully be a way to do it. I want people to embrace it in that way.
And the key message is eat more plants, eat 30 different plants a week. Is that right?
Yeah, and it and they don't have to all be, and they're not all kale, so you don't have to. any idea? And people just need to remind themselves what plants actually are. Most of what we eat is plants, but nuts, you know, peanuts are plants, seeds are plants, herbs are plants. So the more you mix it up, the better, and the more your microbes will like it. And just realize that, you know, you're not just eating for yourself, you're now eating for all those microbes.
And if you haven't downloaded the COVID-19 app yet, you must do that. Do your duty, because it is important, so Tim can get some readings. It's called the COVID Symptom Study, isn't it? That's the app.
COVID Symptom Study app. And if you go, there's a website, you can download both Android and Apple on it. And this is all a free, this is a free service. And it's, you go to the website called covid.joinzoe.com. And there's also packed full of information and stuff. And when we announce the results of the nutrition trial and on COVID, which we will shortly, because we've just amazingly, we've got nearly a million people have done a full dietary questionnaire. It's the biggest dietary study in the world. And we'll be revealing those hopefully in a few weeks. That'll be fun.
Yeah, I filled out mine. It's honestly, it's just it's nothing to do. It takes seconds to do every day, and it just feeds back vital information to Tim for his study. And you know, it's well worth doing. Thank you so much for doing that. And let's hope the government get behind it as well, because I think it'd be great for us to get more knowledge on the app. Thanks a lot for joining me again, Tim. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure, likewise.
Thank you. I'll speak to you soon, hopefully.
Yes. Bye.